So we'll be looking this morning at verses 47 through 57. And so many questions could jump into our mind when we consider what the people have just witnessed. What were they thinking? What was said after seeing Lazarus alive and well once again? It's so easy to think of the questions that would be in our mind. Like, for example, Lazarus, where were you? What was it like? Were you in heaven? I have never been a proponent of the idea of soul sleep. If you're not familiar, soul sleep is the idea that when you die, you are not able to, or you're not really conscious of anything until the resurrection of the last day, and then we will all go to heaven. We don't believe that. I don't believe that that's true. I believe, as Scripture says, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. But I almost hope in the case of Lazarus that it was something like that, so that he wasn't dragged away from heaven after 4 days when Christ called him out of the grave. But perhaps he was. Perhaps, like Paul, his explanation when people would ask the question. Paul wrote, in I believe, to the Corinthians and talked about the fact that he had a dream, or he found himself on the Lord's day in heaven. It was more than a dream, it was a vision, really. And his description was simply, the things that I saw were too wonderful for me to describe. That wasn't the point. Perhaps that was how Lazarus would respond to such a question. We simply don't know. The Apostle John does not indulge our curiosity with specific details and interesting stories of what followed this event. He does not dial in on Lazarus' perspective. Instead, we turn to the response of the Pharisees. So notice as we read the arrogance and foolishness of the Pharisees and consider the underlying motivation behind their decision. So again, verses 47 through the end of the chapter, of chapter 11. This is our custom. Of course, I will read the text and then say, "This is the word of the Lord. May he who gave it be praised," and I'll ask you to repeat with me, and may we who hear it obey. John 11, 47 and following. "Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council and said, 'What do we? For this man doth many miracles. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation.' And one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, 'Ye know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not.' When this spake he, not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation. And not for that nation only, but also, or that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad. Then from that day forth they took counsel together for to put him to death. Jesus therefore walked no more openly among the Jews, but went thence unto a country near to the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. And the Jews' Passover was nigh at hand, and many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then sought they for Jesus, and spake among themselves as they stood in the temple, 'What think ye, that he would not come to the feast?' Now both of the chief priests and the Pharisees, or now both the chief priests and the Pharisees, had given a commandment that if any man knew where he were, he should show it that they might take him." This is the word of the Lord. May he who gave it be praised, and may we who hear it obey. Heavenly Father, as we come before your word this morning, I pray that you would speak to our hearts, that you would show us the truths that you have for us here. And Lord, that we might truly understand how we are to walk and how we are to respond from this negative example, what not to do, but yet to also glean what we can expect many to do in response to the gospel. We ask that you would give us wisdom. I pray that I would speak clearly, and that what I say would be limited to the truths of your word, that I would not add nor take away from the truths that you have brought us here to receive this morning. And it's in your name that I pray. Amen. Well, again, the title on the screen is incorrect. Our title this morning, Don't Be a Useful Idiot. As we come to our text this morning, consider the Cold War by way of illustration. Now, during the Cold War, nearly the entire world was divided on the issue of communism. I'm speaking to some who remember what those days were like. I obviously was not yet around. But the Western world was vehemently opposed to the communists, while the East, spearheaded by the Soviet Union, had fully embraced communism. There was certainly a physical aspect to the conflict. This war of sorts, the Cuban crisis, and other events. But in this conflict, the future of the entire world literally hung in the balance. But it was perhaps, more than any other human conflict, an ideological impasse. It was not so much Germany versus the world, or Germany and Japan, like World War II, or it really wasn't a war of that sort. It wasn't necessarily Russia and America, but it was ideological distinctions. How would the world move forward? And it was perhaps the first time in the history of America that our enemies recognized the greatest weakness of our democratic republic was not necessarily a military blind spot or infrastructural vulnerability, but rather the suffrage of millions of unintelligent and manipulable people. As has been said in many other contexts as well, if you get the kids, you get everything. Communist propaganda began to flood the cultural conversation throughout the West. Well, during this time, those who were staunch opponents of communism began to use the term useful idiots to refer to those who were drawn in by communistic propaganda. The definition is a useful idiot or a useful fool is a person perceived as propagandizing for a cause without fully comprehending the cause's goals. One who is cynically being used by the cause's leaders. The term has often been used to denote whether in fact or merely perception that an individual is susceptible to psychological manipulation. It is in that sense that we use this term this morning. The title of this sermon is reflecting a useful idiot. Someone who is propagating, who is propagandizing, someone who is promoting, someone who is evangelizing, if you will, to their cause, without understanding what that cause is. This could be true of many things today, whether it's a political agenda, right? Whether it is on the social issues, whether we're talking about the cults and false religions of the world. So many are going to realize, but not before it's too late, while they thought that they were serving God, Mormons, Muslims, Jehovah's Witnesses. They'll realize they were truly just a useful idiot of the devil. So many are willing to embrace falsehood and do so and become the puppets of an ideological system which is actually morally bankrupt, but which they perceive as the truth. Well, rather than being manipulated into supporting a political system that will ultimately destroy their nation's prosperity, which we may be watching before our eyes, these men and women are manipulated into hatred of and war against the very one who offers them eternal life. You can be a faithful follower of Christ, or you can be a useful idiot of Satan and his demons. The choice is up to you. These Pharisees, here in chapter 11, chose the latter. We have 3 points this morning. First of all, God's enemies hate Christ. Secondly, God's enemies still accomplish his, God's, purposes. And thirdly, God's enemies will persecute his people. God's enemies hate Christ. They will still accomplish his purposes, and they will persecute his people. First of all, God's enemies hate Christ. We see this in verses 47 and 48. What has just happened is a miraculous resurrection of Lazarus, the greatest miracle recorded for us prior to the resurrection. But we read in verse 47, in verse 46, some came and told the Pharisees what was going on. In verse 47, then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council and said, "What do we do? For this man doth many miracles." The Pharisees' hatred of Christ was a well-established point. We have seen it throughout the book of John already. They had already called for his death and attempted to seize him on multiple occasions. Leon Morris states in his commentary of this passage, "It has always been the case that those whose minds are made up to oppose what Christ stands for will not be convinced by any amount of evidence. In this spirit, these men recognize that the miracles have taken place, but find in this a reason for more wholehearted opposition, not for faith. In their hardness of heart, they continue on their own chosen line and refuse to consider the evidence before their eyes." Hey, boss. Some of us were at a funeral last week, and, you know, we were kind of hanging around. The sister of the guy that died was really taking it hard. We're trying to console her, and 4 days? Was it 4 days? Yes, 4 days after he died, Jesus showed up, and he came back to life. He lives a couple miles down the road, actually. You could go talk to him if you want. What are we going to do about this? Clearly, we have to go kill the guy. That's their answer. Okay. I know this sounds crazy, but he was dead a few days ago, and he's not dead now. And we need to go kill him. Maybe that won't work. The guy was already dead. What are we going to do? He can clearly raise people from the dead. Well, the foolishness of the Pharisees is immediately obvious. They are squaring up against a man who has clearly demonstrated he possesses divine power. How do we explain this clear lack of discernment? Well, there's a few things. First of all, the enemies of God are troubled by Christ's power. Baked into this is a recognition of the legitimacy of Jesus' miracles. What do they say in verse 47? Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council and said, "What do we do? For this man doeth many miracles." They wouldn't be troubled by his power if the miracles weren't real. If the miracles of Jesus recorded for us in the New Testament were a figment of John's imagination, the Pharisees would not have had to respond to them at all. There would be no cause for concern. So we'll put to silence immediately those who would attempt to rule out the supernatural from the gospel accounts. Kenneth Gangle notes here, "There was no denial of the miracle, but a clamor for some plan to cut losses and protect the religious hierarchy in the future. The faith of some was countered by the hostility of others as formal religious leaders put aside other differences to combine their opposition to this annoying prophet who opened the eyes of the blind and now raised the dead." You see, the Pharisees and the Sadducees had to come together. The gospel message will always bring division. Some will embrace Christ and follow him, but others choose to see Christ as a threat to the earthly things that they love. They saw this as such a threat that they came together. The Pharisees and the Sadducees are the two kind of ruling classes of not just the religious, but the civil governing, right? So if you want to think about it on a political parallel, right? We have Republicans and we have Democrats. And sometimes the Republicans are in control of the House and the Senate, or one or the other. And sometimes the Republicans, sometimes Democrats, sometimes Republicans control one or the other, right? Well, you have the Pharisees and you have the Sadducees, okay? And when the high priest is from the Sadducees, he gets to appoint a bunch of people to this court, which is called the Sanhedrin. And so you have the high priest who's from the Sadducees. And so you have a predominantly Sadducee-heavy Sanhedrin right now. Okay? Now the Pharisees are, because of that, they're still around, but they're not the ones in power necessarily. And so they get stuck with, you know, dealing with the stuff people really don't want to mess with, right? And so it's like, yeah, you're still here, you're still part of the group, but the high priest isn't one of you guys right now. And so you can do kind of the lesser work, right? It's kind of like promoting your friends to the higher offices where they don't have to do so much of the dirty work, right? It's kind of how this works out. And that's why, so far, when it came to dealing with Jesus, it was mainly the Pharisees, right? Jesus was not brought before the high priest yet, though he was going to be shortly. But basically, you know, these complaints and things, it's like, okay, fix it, you know? This is some random, you know, self-proclaimed prophet just teaching out wherever he goes. You should be able to handle this, right? It would be like us, right? If we had somebody and they started standing on the corner out here, and every Sunday morning at 9 o'clock and at noon, they were just out there preaching whatever they wanted to preach to you all as you're coming into church and as you're going out of church, right? And then at some point, Brother Don comes to me and he says, "Boy, you know, we've lost half the crowd to this guy standing out in the corner." It's like, okay, well. At some point, you'd have to look around and say, that's ridiculous. Right? You are here preaching. Obviously, we recognize some problems with our facilities, right? And some things are a little run down. But you shouldn't be, it shouldn't be more enticing for people to come stand on the corner of your property and listen to a guy standing by the stop sign just out in the elements versus coming in and listen to the church. So maybe the problem is your message, right? But what is the solution? Well, they're troubled by Christ's power. They're also jealous of his influence, kind of getting to. The wording of verse 47 here in the King James is a little more ambiguous than it could be. The council, it says that they called a council. The council that's called is a gathering of the Sanhedrin. Grant Osborne comments here, the Sanhedrin was the Jewish high council into whose hands the Romans had placed authority for civil and religious affairs. It was made up of 70 Jewish leaders, some chief priests. That's the extended family of the high priest, all right? There's only one high priest, but when you see multiple chief priests, that's because the high priest gets to appoint people to that office. or sometimes other temple officials, all of the Sadducees. So sometimes it's family, sometimes it's friend, right? But these are Sadducees who dominated at this time, as we mentioned. Also included in that 70, some Pharisees, which are lay leaders and experts of law, and some elders, the landed aristocracy, right? So they would bring in some wealthy people of the Jewish leaders. They're not necessarily serving as priests right now, but they're on this council because of their family connections, with the high priest leading it. The Sanhedrin was a kind of combination of a house of parliament and Supreme Court all rolled into one. The Sanhedrin declared that you were guilty, you had no hope of appeal. They were the highest religious and civil authority in Judean culture. Now, remember that the Jews are under the Roman government at this time, but the Romans had learned that when they conquered various people and their territory, that the transition was easier if the conquered people were just allowed some level of self-governance. Now, if you go conquer a people that have some ridiculous laws where they're totally, you know, not even able to keep themselves afloat, well, then Roman law kind of comes in and you have to follow Roman law. But when they conquered an area where there was a decent cultural standard already, and that, you know, criminals were criminalized and were dealt with, and general civilized life was possible, well, the Romans would say, okay, you're under us and you report to us, and then they would stipulate, you know, what rises to the bar that you have to report it to the Roman officials. But for the most part, they would just let that go on as normal because the people who are preserving some level of normalcy are less likely to revolt and cause you more problems. The Sanhedrin maintained a very high level of authority compared to other conquered groups in the Roman Empire. The only thing that the Sanhedrin couldn't do when they were dealing with Jewish problems, right? Obviously, they couldn't, you know, bring other people outside of their own into their own system. But the only thing that they couldn't do within their own people is that the Sanhedrin couldn't carry out capital punishment. If you thought that a man must be killed for his crime, that had to rise to the Roman officials, which is why Jesus had to be brought before Pilate. The Jewish leaders realized that if Rome determined that they were handling things poorly, then the Sanhedrin's judicial power could be greatly diminished and perhaps eliminated completely. We see that in verse 48. They say, if we let him thus alone, or if we let him do what he's doing, then all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation. If Jesus, in essence their argument, if Jesus is allowed to do this, everybody's going to believe he is who he says he is, and they're going to listen to him, and they're going to do what he says, and we're not going to have any control over how Rome looks at us as the Jewish people. And we cannot trust this man to keep Rome happy with what's going on. And even if he were, we wouldn't be the ones in control. That's their problem. Osborne continues here, since many of the first century rebellions were messianic in nature, these uprisings of the people, somebody would claim to be a Messiah, because the Jews religiously are looking forward to a coming Messiah, right? So some false pretender would claim to be the Messiah and then try to start a political uprising against Rome, which is exactly what the people who listened to Jesus wanted him to do. In John chapter 6, after the feeding of the 5,000, they wanted him to go start a political revolution because they looked at the Messiah as one who would throw off Roman oppression. They weren't so interested in freeing them from sin. Nevertheless, this was a powerful speculation by the Jewish leaders. But what soon became clear is that they would take extreme action against anything they considered a threat to their own power and authority. Osborne concludes saying, note that there was no consideration that he, Jesus, might actually be the Messiah. They had already hardened their hearts and were no longer open to the truth. We see that that is because they are motivated by selfishness. They are motivated by selfishness. The enemies of God are motivated by selfishness. The Jewish leaders are acting entirely out of their own interests. While they claim that the people will suffer, their true issue with Jesus is that he is undermining their authority. Christ repeatedly demonstrated errors in the teaching of the Pharisees. No error could be more glaring than their failure to acknowledge the authenticity of Jesus' messianic claim. Jesus, in essence, is there saying, I speak for God. The Jewish leaders are there saying, no, we speak for God. Jesus, in essence, with the miracles, says, prove it. Here's my proof. A blind man can see. Here's my proof. Lazarus is alive. Where's your proof that's walking around talking to people after being dead for 4 days? Where's your proof that's seeing after being blind for decades? Where's your proof? Here's my proof. All the miracles. Where's your proof? They have none. The Pharisees had successfully convinced the Jewish people that serving God and obeying the ruling religious class were synonymous, and Jesus was messing that up. They had a system where the average person thought, how do I please God? Do what the priest says. Do what the Pharisees say. And Jesus is coming and messing that all up. He's totally flipping that on its head. By the way, this same deception is present in false religions and cults. Perhaps it's most clearly seen in the Roman Catholic Church. Caiaphas, who we're about to look at, serves as a pope-like figure, equating his own decisions as the will of God. Today, many are no different than the Pharisees, though it may not come in the veneer of Judaism very often. Still today, those who reject Christ do so out of hatred. God's sovereignty outweighs our autonomy in every area of life. We don't like that. I like to think that I am a free man and I can do what I want and I can make the decisions that I want to make and I can do really whatever I want to do. And yes, there's some earthly consequences for some of the things I can do, but you can't stop me from doing whatever it is that's within my power to do. I'm my own man. That is, at the very least, the atomistic view prevalent in the West. But then you bring God's sovereignty to bear on that idea, and it basically crushes it. As we were talking about in Sunday school this morning, what am I going to do? Everything exactly conformly to the foreknowledge of God. So when you make yourself the enemy of God, and everything, every action, every word, everything you do is already known by God, already decreed by God, even. How do you fight against your enemy? Who not only knows everything that you're going to do, but as we'll look next, is going to orchestrate everything that you do and has already planned to orchestrate everything that you do, knowing exactly what it will be for his ultimate purposes. Is free will real? Yes. But it's real like this earth is real. Is this earth real? Yes or no? Yes. Is this earth as real as heaven? No. Is this body as real as the next? No. Is it real? Yes. But when you compare it to God's eternal creation, this pales in comparison. You have strength, yes? Some strength in your body. You have some power in your body. You have some wisdom in your mind. But compared to God's, your strength, your wisdom, your power is nothing. And I find it interesting that when we start talking about will, we just suddenly impose a level of logic. And it's a semantic argument. It's just playing with words. But we impose a level of logic that we don't impose on any other attribute of God. Is God all-powerful, yes or no? We'll ask you to raise your hand. You say, I believe the Bible teaches God is all-powerful. Raise your hand. Okay. Do you have some power? Well, how is God all-powerful? How does he have all power if you have some power? You say, that's a stupid argument. Is God all-knowing? Does he have all wisdom? Do you have some knowledge and some wisdom? Well, how does God have all knowledge and all wisdom if you're keeping some of it? But then we talk about God's sovereign will. Well, if God is sovereign over all things, how am I sovereign over anything? How do any of my decisions matter? How do my choices do anything? I'm just doing what God decreed that I was going to have to do, and so it doesn't mean anything at all. And my point is, you can think that if you want, but you're just as stupid as the guy who's like, God's not all powerful because look, I can punch a wall. God's will overpowers yours. Just like God's wisdom overpowers yours and God's strength overpowers yours. But for some reason, when you get into the idea of his desire, his volition, his will, That's where everybody wants to stand up and be like, well, that's not right. It's dumb. But we're talking about useful idiots, I suppose. So perhaps that makes sense. Many are jealous of God's power over us and quickly make themselves judges over God, which is immediately what you do. Right? Paul talks about it in Romans chapter 9, but that's immediately, you get into the topic of God's sovereignty, and what do we as, you know, pea-brained human beings immediately do? Well, hopefully if we're following Scripture, we don't do this, but in our flesh, what we immediately do is say, well, that means that God does this. That's wicked. If God's sovereign over all things, then he causes the hurricane that kills people. He causes the house fire that killed my neighbor. He causes XYZ, ABC, whatever, elemental P. God does X, and that's wicked. Therefore, God must be wicked. No. That's not categorically correct. We've gone into that. Biblically speaking, the problem with that is it assumes the innocence of human beings, which is not a biblical doctrine. God cannot sin by taking what he has given. He has given everything. Anything that he takes is rightfully his. Right? It is not a sin for me to hand, you know, my cell phone or something to Joey to then kind of fool around with and typically ends up chewing on it, right? If I do that, it's not a sin for me to take it back. Why? Because it's mine. God has not given us anything but as stewards. So the only claim that we can have to anything that is ours is if God has promised never to take it away. There's only one thing God's given you which he's promised never to take away, and what is that? Himself. Salvation. He gives you a nice car, he can take it away. He gives you a decent income, he can take it away. He gives you a nice life, he can take it away. He gives you breath in your lungs, he can take it away. He gives you eternal life, he can't take it away because he's promised he'll never take it away. But many are jealous of God's power over us, and it quickly causes them to begin judging God. That's what the Sanhedrin's doing. They're jealous of his influence. They're troubled by his power. They're motivated in selfishness. So what do? They judge him. They're literally saying, he needs to be put to death for this crime? I mean, there wasn't a rule on the books, a law on the books, that performing miracles was criminal because nobody could perform miracles. But, you know, whatever. Whatever charges they were trying to make stick, I don't know. You know, our son Joey is getting to the point now that he can crawl around and play with things, and his sister often gets quite annoyed when he starts playing with her toys, right? The problem is that Rosie thinks that all toys, and even a lot of things that aren't toys, are her toys. So I've had to come in and have the same conversation several times recently with Rosie that, Rosie, you're not in charge. You're not the master or the ruler or the one charged with your little brother's obedience. If daddy says you need to share and play nice, that settles it. You need to share and play nice. If you want to play with this toy, then you need to let Joey play with this other toy or whatever. Now, after I have stepped in, if Rosie continues to fight with her brother, well, playtime is over. We have to go take a nap or whatever else is needed, right? See, Rosie, as a 2-year-old, has some autonomy. She can choose what she plays with and what she wants to do. But when she begins making decisions that violate our rules, her authority clashes with her father's. Or her autonomy, clashes with her father's authority. When your autonomy clashes with an authority, guess what? You lose. Say, I have freedom to go do whatever I want. I'm going to take that freedom and I'm going to go rob a bank. Congratulations. As soon as you're caught, your freedom's over. We send you to this wonderful place called jail, right? Why? Because you used your autonomy to go against the authority of a higher power. Whether it's spanking a young child, grounding a teenager, or arresting a criminal, choosing to act in a way contrary to the instructions of those in authority over you will lead to your autonomy being overruled. The same is true with God. Ironically, the Jewish leaders recognized this and were respectful as they sought to toe the line with Rome. But they refused to submit to Christ's authority as their Messiah. What do they say in verse 28? If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and their nation. The arrogance and the foolishness of the Pharisees, of the Sanhedrin here. Because again, what did you just watch? You just watched Jesus raise a man from the dead. And you went and hid in your little meeting room, and the discussion was, we've got to stop him, because if we don't stop the guy who has power over life and death itself, Rome's going to come in and tell us what to do. Who has more power, Rome or Christ? It's not a trick question. Who has more power, Rome or Christ? Yeah, where's Rome? Christ rose from the dead and seated at the right hand of the Father. Where's Rome? 6 feet under. More than that now, probably. Whoever these Pharisees were fearing, they know now they've made the wrong calculation. They figured that out probably when the soldiers came back, the tomb is empty. Definitely a second after they died. God's enemies hate Christ. Secondly, we see God's enemies still accomplish his purposes. Verse 49. And one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, you know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation perish not. We see here, God's enemies are arrogant. In this meeting of the Sanhedrin, Caiaphas takes center stage and declares the action that must be taken. In doing so, Caiaphas serves here as sort of the poster boy of opposing Christ. He's the high priest. He'll have that role again here in the narrative in a couple of chapters. But for now, Caiaphas is the vocal opponent of Christ in this meeting. We see that he's very arrogant. What does he say as he gets started? One of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, he gets up. What's he lead with? You know nothing at all! It's a great way to win people over to your decision, right? No, that's what you say when you already assume you're the man in charge. And are very disrespectful of the people with you, right? Caiaphas's arrogance is apparent from the moment that he opens his mouth. He begins, in essence, by telling his cohorts that they're so stupid they're still asking questions. What are they doing in verse 48?
Well, if we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him. And the Romans, they're just like going on. They say in verse 47,
what do we do? Or what are we doing? Like, what's going on? Clearly, our current action is not sufficient. Caiaphas declares the only solution is that Jesus must be killed. This is also arrogant because, as I mentioned a few moments ago, the Sanhedrin had extensive civil authority, but they were not allowed to carry out capital punishment. So, to the Romans, who, the previous verse, they were so worried about keeping things good with the Romans, Caiaphas is here making a command that's above his pay grade. Jesus needs to die. Wait, that's the one thing you're not allowed to decide. Your council is not given that authority. And they've already given up, right? Because the argument could be made, well, they have that authority under God. Well, yeah, not to go kill God, right? They've already abandoned following God's authority. So the only thing they've got left is the authority that Rome is giving them, right? And now they're about to go violate that to keep things cool with Rome. Idiocy. Again, useful idiot in the hand of Satan. Then they're blasphemous. God's enemies are blasphemous. All right, I guess I have all of these coming together at the same time. The blasphemy of the Sanhedrin here is on display in various ways. First of all, they're holding this meeting in the temple. The temple is God's house, right? So they are literally sitting in God's house discussing how they will go about killing God's son. Whoa. If we're not careful, we do the very same thing, perhaps varying in degree, but not in kind, when we begin to allow God's house to be a mouthpiece for man's ideas instead of a herald of God's word. If you walk into here and sit in the pew, your expectation should be, I'm going to hear from God from this pulpit this morning. Which means, if we do not ensure that that is what is being done from this pulpit on Sunday morning, we are using God's house to spread man's lies. We are using God's house to proclaim a human being's authority rather than God's authority. So too often when we look at things like this and say, well, I would never do something like that. Careful. Because we have. In many, many of our churches. And even at times, I'm sure, in our own thoughts. Secondly, they downplay Jesus' divinity. What does Caiaphas say here? He says in verse 50, "Nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation perish not." What is he estimating? First of all, he's saying, well, Jesus is just some guy, right? Jesus is just some guy. If he dies, who cares? The important thing is maintaining the authority of the Jews, of the Jewish leaders. It's better for him to die than for our nation to be removed from power. Our nation, meaning our Jewish council, right? Because the idea is, the threat is, they're going to follow Jesus. He's going to screw things up. And the Romans are going to come in, and they're going to set it straight, and they're not going to give us the permissions to govern ourselves anymore. Right? That's the argument. They're going to make us all Romans, and only Roman law matters. By the way, this is just a side note, but when we start minimizing God, we immediately start deifying men. They are minimizing who Jesus is. He's just some man, one man. It's better for one man to die than for the nation to be. Well, who's more valuable, Jesus Christ or the nation of Israel? Jesus Christ, second member of the Godhead. Far more valuable. God is far more valuable than any number, every number, all sum of humanity. He is certainly more valuable than the nation of Israel. So already, terrible calculation. But they're minimizing Christ's power. They're minimizing his claim of authority. They're minimizing everything despite the evidence. And they're deifying Rome. As if, well, Rome can just come in and do whatever they want. Rome is the true sovereign in the mind of the Pharisees, which is why when they come to the crucifixion and Pilate says, "Here is your king," they say, "We have no king but Caesar." They've rejected their king. They've rejected their God. They will soon hang him on a tree. We see as well that God ordains their steps. No matter how much you strive to defy God's will, God will use every act you take and every word you speak to accomplish his divine will. It's so interesting what he says. What is John? This is John's commentary on what Caiaphas says. Caiaphas says, in verse 49, one of them named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, "You know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation perish not." And then John steps in and says, "And this spake he, not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation. And not for that nation only, but that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad." No matter how much you strive to defy God's will, he will accomplish his will through you. Caiaphas intends to make a point with his words, but God superintends his speech to speak a word of genuine prophecy. Caiaphas says, "It is expedient. It is expedient for us that one man should die for the people." That's true. That one man, Jesus Christ, was about to die for the people. But what God meant and what Caiaphas meant were totally different things. You see the frustration the enemy of God has against the sovereignty of God? I'm angry and I'm fighting, and all the while God can make come out from my lips exactly what he wants. Caiaphas, it's interesting, it says, verse 49, and also in verse 51, in both cases it says, Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, verse 49, and verse 51, "And this he spake not of himself, but being high priest that year." Well, what does it mean, that year? Okay, remember where we're at. We're in the Gospel of John. What we're about to see, Passover, is right around the corner. We're pretty close to the cross. You have Passover. He comes in, triumphal entry within a week. They're crying out, "Crucify him." Point is, this is the last year that there's a high priest. The high priest has already, Caiaphas, completely rejected God. But in his office, it is still legitimate for one more week, and God has every power to speak through him in any case. You've rejected me, but you're in my office where I appointed you. I will speak through you. God ordains the steps even of his enemies, and they serve God's purposes. Osborne states here, Caiaphas didn't realize the significance of what he said. John tells us that one man should die for the people was actually an unconscious prophecy. The language used here is interesting. As high priest at that time, he was led to prophesy. In the Old Testament, the high priest was God's spokesman and often declared the will of God, which he ascertained by means of the Urim and Thummim. I've been talking about that in Ezra. The priests were not allowed to be priest until that could be declared. It never happened. Even at times given a prophetic voice by God. This was the case here, but Caiaphas didn't realize it. As we consider Caiaphas the useful idiot in this passage, we recognize that you, like Caiaphas, will be useful in the sense that God will accomplish his will through you regardless of your disposition to him. While you will be useful, you will be useful. God's will be accomplished through you whether you're a willing party to it or not. So you will be useful in that sense, but you needn't be an idiot. Unlike Caiaphas, you can choose to submit to Christ and cooperate willingly as he works through you, through your faith and humility, rather than working in spite of your pride and hostility. Finally, we see, I guess I have those all going dim together. Finally, God's enemies will persecute his people. They will resort to violence. Verse 53. Then from that day forth, they took counsel together for to put him to death. It's no surprise that wicked men who oppose righteousness will turn to violence. When you abandon truth, you're incapable of winning an intellectual debate on the merits of your beliefs. So the only way to appear victorious is to shut up your opponent. This is why, for example, the proponents of sexual depravity today, by the way, that's a new tagline, right? Start using that, all right? That's free. You don't have to give me credit for it. But don't call it the LGBT community, okay? It's not a community, right? It is, they are, proponents of sexual depravity, all right? There you go. Don't have to give me credit for that. I probably stole it from somebody. But they focus so heavily on labeling opposing opinions as hate speech, right? You use the wrong pronoun. Well, that's hate speech. Well, there's no logical argument for the nonsense being pushed on young people and the so-called affirming care, which is nothing short of psychological manipulation and physical abuse. And so for these lies to gain ground, the truth must either be silenced or ignored. So we have to call it hate speech so that you can't say it. Because if you do, you'll be in trouble because it's illegal to say, sir, when you're clearly a sir, but dressed like a woman. Sir is perhaps too respectful, but the gender is correct in that statement. The Pharisees must kill Jesus because they cannot win a debate against him. In fact, it's been proven throughout, they can't even score a point. Everything they charge him with, he then brings scripture, and he brings truth, and he brings the obvious reality around to point out how foolish what they just said was. And, I mean, to some extent, that's just very understandable. They were quite literally arguing with the know-it-all. Not in the arrogant sense, but in the fact sense. He literally knows it all. They will harness your faith against you. Again, sorry I have this formatting error here, but they will harness your faith against you. The Jews know that Jesus will come to the Passover feast. We read that in verse 54. Jesus, therefore, walked no more openly among the Jews, but went thence unto a country near the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. So the Sanhedrin convenes, they proclaim that he must die, Jesus gets out of town. But they know he's not going to be gone for very long because, verse 55, and the Jews' Passover was nigh at hand, and many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then sought they for Jesus and spake among themselves as they stood in the temple, what think ye, that he will not come to the feast? Any good Jew is going to come to the Passover feast. They know Jesus is a good Jew. They will harness his religion, his faith against him, and they will do the same to you. Verse 57, now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a commandment that if any man knew where he were, he should show it that they might take him. They will leverage others against you as well. This is exactly what they did to Jesus. The Jews know that Jesus will come to the Passover feast. We've already seen this a couple of times. They kind of ramp things up at the beginning of a feast because they know he's going to show up in Jerusalem. They want to kill him and prevent any more mass conversions from taking place. There's a sense in which the Pharisees are taking a page out of the playbook from the wise men of Daniel's day. Realizing they are dealing with a man of consistent character, they count on his faithfulness and will attempt to use it to trap him. See that the Jewish leaders attempt to deputize the entirety of the population in bringing Jesus before their corrupt court. Jesus has many followers and sympathizers by this time, but they are still a small fraction of the massive crowds who will be coming to Jerusalem for the feast. Jesus risks being recognized anywhere he goes, so Jerusalem must be avoided until his time has come. Recognize this in John 15, verse 20. Jesus says, remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they have persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they have kept my sayings, they will keep yours also. Unless God has chosen to send another great awakening in the hearts and minds of a new American generation, and that may be true. But if it's not, we will see physical persecution become the norm on this continent. I'm not a prophet and I'm not making a radical prediction. I'm simply declaring the biblical fact that persecution is a normal aspect of following Christ. Peter makes this point very clearly in 1 Peter 4. Verses 12 through 14, he says, beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. But rejoice inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings. This is not just stubbing my toe or hitting my thumb with a hammer when we're talking about fiery trials. This is persecution. Inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's suffering, that when his glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy. If you be reproached for the name of Christ, you don't hit your thumb with a hammer because of your stand for Christ. All right, we're talking about persecution. If you're reproached for the name of Christ, happy are ye, for the spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. On their part he is evil spoken of, but on your part he is glorified. If God is to glorify himself through the church in America, it is very likely the church in America will glorify him through her response to persecution. This is abnormal. The freedom that we have experienced in this nation is abnormal, and it will likely come to an end sooner rather than later. Why? Because God's enemies hate Christ God's enemies accomplish his purposes, and God's enemies persecute his people. So we conclude this morning. Caiaphas, like so many of the Jewish leaders of Jesus' day, didn't discover fully till the moment he left this world and entered eternal torment that he had been a useful idiot all along. He thought he was the spokesman for the divine, yet he had consistently done the devil's bidding. Nevertheless, his actions had fulfilled God's purposes in spite of the heart with which they were conducted. Caiaphas experienced personally the peril of those who reject a clear gospel witness, which is described for us in Matthew chapter 7. Verses 22 and 23, we even heard it in the video during Sunday school. Many will say to me, Jesus says, in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. Caiaphas heard those words despite being the high priest in the temple of God and prophesying that Jesus would take the sins of the world. He spoke the gospel, and he was not saved by it. Don't be a useful idiot in the hands of those who hate God. Be sure you are trusting and following Jesus Christ.